KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. If you're in Oregon, you might get a chance to see the exhibition at the Museum of History and Culture in Eugene that features all Native LGBTQ2 artists. It's called Transgressors. Wherever you are, there's probably a Pride Month event near you. At the same time, there is resistance at the federal level, extending all the way to local school boards when it comes to acknowledging LGBTQ2 progress. We'll get perspectives on Native Pride Month coming up after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. We're continuing to dive into the history of Oak Flat, a site sacred to Native people. Located in Arizona, it may soon be home to one of the largest copper mines in the world. Apache people continue to fight to protect it. KJZZ's Gabriel Piatarazio reports.
An 1871 order from President Ulysses S. Grant established the San Carlos Apache Reservation. This led to rounding up thousands of Apaches, including Geronimo, and marching them to Hell's 40 Acres under military occupation. Some even refer to it as a concentration camp. At that time, the U.S. viewed Apaches as a monolith, but these communities are made up of complex kinship networks of bands and clans, like Tonto, Yavapai, Chiricahua, and many more. Maxima says not all of them got along.
Obviously, when you bring all these different people together on a reservation, there's going to be some ancient cultural clashes, because there was no Apache nation that didn't exist. We wouldn't have ever confined ourselves in that way at all.
Here's history professor Shepard.
So you get this flurry of executive orders, but it's also tied with the just horribly violent clampdown on Apaches in the Southwest. They're really waging a military, but also a bureaucratic war on Apaches as a people, but also upon their land.
Their reservation changed size 6 times, and Maxima says mineral wealth was a driving motivator.
And of course, that means the extermination of Apache peoples in the region.
Shepard says that's not hyperbole.
Rounding people up, concentrating them on reservations, deporting them. And as that happens, we start to see the emergence of that federal land management regime take over the territory as public domain.
In 1955, President Dwight D. Eisenhower incorporated Oak Flat into the Tonto National Forest, where it remains to this day. And Maxima believes if Apaches remained nomadic and weren't restricted to reservations,
Oak Flat would still become a very prominent place for Apaches to travel to.
Gabriel Piatarazio, Phoenix.
Devastating wildfires across western Canada have forced thousands of people from their homes, including those in Indigenous communities. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, for many First Nations, the crisis is one of temporary accommodation.
According to the latest statistics, and they change quickly, more than 30,000 people in Saskatchewan and Manitoba have been forced to leave their homes and are displaced. Hundreds of homes have been destroyed, many Indigenous people have been flown out of remote communities, and satellite images show that in some regions the situation is worsening. In Winnipeg, Manitoba's largest city, there isn't much left. Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs Grand Chief Kyra Wilson says the situation has become dire.
And we see young children and families waiting in whatever environment that they're in, waiting to go to, you know, their secondary accommodation, whatever that is, whether that's one of the congregate shelters, whether that's a hotel, whether that's out of province. And it's really sad to see, you know, our children having to sleep on floors. People are sitting, waiting in hallways, waiting outside. And right now, we just need everybody to come together.
In Ottawa, the federal government has deployed military personnel to help fight the fires. Officials say the firefighting service has now been stretched to the maximum, and the call has gone out to Canada's international partners for help. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Support provided by First National Bank Alaska, offering a one-solution, tailored approach to meet the financial needs of Alaskans by providing banking services, loans, investments, and more to help shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at FNBAlaska.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The closing ceremony is this weekend for World Pride Week in Washington, D.C. It's the first time since 2019 the international LGBTQ2 event with parades, concerts, and political rallies has been held in the U.S. But organizers say attendance and corporate sponsorship are both down, mainly because of policies and rhetoric originating in the White House. The Trump administration refuses to acknowledge Pride Month. At the same time, a record number of openly LGBTQ candidates are running for office in 2026, and resistance has galvanized awareness efforts around the country. Today we're going to hear about an exhibition of Native LGBTQ2 artists in Oregon and get recommendations for books by Native authors. Of course, you can join the conversation too. Just call us at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Cornelius, Oregon is Felix Furby. He is one of two co-curators of the Transgressors exhibit at the Museum of Natural and Cultural History in Eugene, Oregon. He is from the Chinook Indian Nation and the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. Felix, good morning and welcome to Native America Calling.
Good morning, Chris Tisan.
Joining us from Salt Lake City, Utah is Calvin Crosby. He is the owner of the King's English Bookshop and the executive director of Brain Food Books. He's also a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Cal, good morning to you as well, and welcome back to the show.
Good morning, and thank you.
You bet. Well, Felix, I want to begin with you. Let's talk about the new art exhibition, Transgressors, you and one of the co-curators, Anthony Hudson, worked on. It looks at present and future Indigenous and queer identity. Tell us more about the goal of the show.
Yeah, so this show is a follow-up to the last show that we did, and we actually wrote them at the same time. My Father's Father's Sister, Our Ancestor Shumkum, which was a historical show or exhibition focused on a Grand Ronde ancestor who is trans-feminine, Shumkum or Nancy Jack. And Transgressors is a follow-up of, something much more future-focused, present and future-oriented. And it's a group of Indigiqueer artists responding to the prompt, imagine a future with us in it. What does that future look like? What does that bring up? Like, what do we want to communicate? What do we want to say about us and our experience today? And what do we want out of that future?
How's the reception so far in Eugene?
Very positive so far. A lot of people are saying that, you know, that this gives them hope, which I'm very glad for. It was something that I was hoping for.
Well, I'm looking at some information online. There was a Facebook announcement on May 15th for opening night, a celebration. There's some images here online. We'll talk more about the details so our listeners can get a better visual of what is being placed on display. But I understand that Transgressors builds on an earlier exhibit that you and Anthony Hudson worked on. It was called My Father's Father's Sister. That's kind of an interesting title. What can you tell us about the theme of that exhibit and how it evolved into Transgressors?
Yeah, so it's my father's father's sister, our ancestor Shamchen, and my father's father's sister actually comes out of a quote from historical texts. And it was something that was very powerful for me to read. Victoria Howard, who is a grand ancestor, she was describing her aunt, and that was the way that she described her aunt, my father's father's sister. And it was just something very impactful for me to just hear that way of describing a trans feminine relative, to just say, my aunt, my auntie, you know, and to have that be in the historical texts. And so we decided to title the show, which honored her, my father's father's sister, after that quote.
That I really like that. And you're so right, the auntie, right? Because I know, like, at Laguna Pueblo, where I'm from, anyone who is a sibling of a grandparent, they're either an uncle or an auntie. Just automatically, that's mm-hmm. what they're referred to. So, yeah, this is so, so interesting. Well, tell us a little bit more about some of the exhibits and what the visitors can expect to see.
Yeah, so there is a little bit of history in this show as well, but it was important for us to make sure to think about the future. And so all the artists, we didn't put any sort of like, restrictions, beyond reasonable restrictions on what they could do. It's like, whatever this prompt brings up for you, whatever you feel like this is, in some way we're agreeing to put our personhood on display, for a couple of years as this show travels. It was really important that everyone was able to communicate in a way that they wanted to. And so most of the artists wrote their own descriptions and introductions, and we have these full sized panels instead of small plaques on the wall, where, like, walking into that room, hopefully what people feel is that they're in community with these people. Our massive interconnected network of communities. I think about that a lot and think about what's good for all of us and the future that we're building together. And I think that it's important for that to come from a place of community and connection.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Felix, we're going to talk a lot more about the exhibit and some of your other work, but I want to bring Cal into the conversation now. Let's talk a little bit about Pride celebrations. And Cal, what's going on there in Salt Lake City where you are? Can you give us a picture of what celebrations look like?
Yeah, so it looks like it's a lot lower key than it has been historically. It is this weekend coming up, so starting tomorrow. And just looking at everything's a little smaller, a little more cohesive, less ambitious.
What do you attribute that to, Cal?
You know, I believe it is the time to prepare for the heart. Prepare, you know, make sure that we're holding our loved ones close. And it's kind of a wait and see mentality. You know, we are the only theocratic state in the union. And so that comes with its own dualities. And this time it's aligned with what's happening in DC. So I think we're all cautious.
Mm-hmm. The governor of Utah decided against a Pride Month declaration. The state was the first to ban unauthorized flags on government property. That's been viewed as a way to stop rainbow flags in schools and city halls. Cal, these actions, how do you think they're affecting residents who are already there, or perhaps other LGBTQ people who might think about moving to Utah?
It'll definitely make anyone thinking of moving here think twice. Before this became the current state of the United States, we were the fourth friendliest gay city as far as Salt Lake goes. You know, outside of Salt Lake, hit or miss, but Salt Lake prided itself on how inclusively we are. The governor's actions definitely do not feel welcoming. And You know, I don't know if they hope we're going away or not, but we've always been here and we're not going away.
King's English Bookshop, do you have anything going on there in celebration of Pride Month?
We have a few authors that are coming in, and, you know, we, even with, like, all the months, different backgrounds and stuff, we showcase authors that reflect that, but we try to make our space welcoming and showing everyone every day that they're welcome and they're seen and that they can find representation.
Cal, in the past, your store, it was the target of a threat related to a planned reading by a drag queen. What effect does that have on you and other residents there, just the overall sense of safety, and also your business?
So I will say that our community, and that's our community of readers, really pulled behind us. We are in a neighborhood. We're in an unusual place. We're not in a strip mall. We're not, we're a freestanding building, but we are very much in a neighborhood. We look like a house that's part of the neighborhood. And our neighbors, who also, you know, the bomb threat is for the neighborhood, were so supportive and so amazing. And the city government, the city officials were so supportive. The police were phenomenal. We never heard from anyone from the state level. And, you know, we're a family-friendly state. I mean, so when someone's threatening to blow up babies, you would think that there would be, I don't know, a cry of outrage beyond Salt Lake City itself. And we, you know, we're not innocent anymore. Like, this came to our neighborhood, and it had repercussions for getting my booksellers to feel safe again. We have all kinds of safety protocols that if you call a bookstore on the east bench of Salt Lake City, maybe shouldn't have never have had. We did find out that they were orchestrated attacks from outside of the U.S. So, you know, it was nobody in our neighborhood. It was nobody in our city. It was nobody in our state. And that gives comfort. And, you know, it was a good conversation starter to remind people that what we do here is more than sell books. It's space we offer for everyone.
Calvin Crosby and Felix Furby joining us today here on Native America Calling. We're talking about Pride Month and other Indigenous issues related to Native LGBTQ2 artists. We're going to talk about the exhibit that's going on there in Eugene, Oregon, and some other topics as well, but we're going to have to take a short break. So we'll be right back, and I encourage listeners to join the conversation. If you'd like to add some perspective or insight to what we're talking about today, you can do that by calling 1-800-996-2848. The forced relocation of a small Alaska village because of climate change has not gone as planned and sends an ominous warning for other Native residents facing a similar fate. We'll check in on the residents of Newtok, Alaska, and others about the complex and difficult move away from their endangered homes. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Simplified in my
Thanks for tuning in today to Native America Calling. We are checking in on LGBTQ progress and challenges that exist during this Pride Month. And you can join our conversation. Just give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. Maybe there are Pride celebrations going on where you live and you'd like to share some information. 1-800-99-NATIVE. You can do that. One of our guests, Calvin Crosby, is the owner of King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City, Utah. And Cal, in addition to all of the work you do and all of your projects, I mean, at the heart of this, you're a business owner. And I want to ask you about a ruling the Supreme Court just made with regard to a woman who said she was treated unfairly at work because she is heterosexual. The court ruled unanimously in favor of her. And as an employer, how do legal decisions like that impact the work that you do?
There's some safety. You know, Utah's a at-will employment state, but I just, number one, the discrimination is discrimination. But I've never seen the situation that this case was about. I've never seen anyone denied work because they're, and I've been working since I was about 12 years old. So for a long time, but that has been a factor in discriminating against someone. Usually in my, well, no, not usually. In my experience, it is a marginalized community that is discriminated against, that doesn't get the job, that doesn't get the promotion. It is the queer, the brown, the black. So as a human being, it frustrates me. And as a business owner, it confounds me because I just don't know what that world is.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about books. And I know you have some indigenous LGBTQ2 book recommendations. One author was even recommended twice, Joshua Whitehead. Let's start with Whitehead and what you like about the work there.
Okay, so Johnny Appleseed and Love After the End, which is an anthology of two-spirit and indigiqueer speculative fiction that he was the editor of. With Johnny Appleseed, he is bold, he is raw, he is honest. Unfortunately, one of my favorite queer authors, Edmund White, I just saw a few minutes ago, passed away within the last 24 hours. And Edmund White is a very much a literary queer author. And he, back in the late 70s, early 80s, was writing about his sexual adventures in New York and his coming of age. Joshua does the same thing, but from a queer indigenous perspective. He's as literary, he's as bold, he's as non, there's no shame, and it's beautiful writing. And I think that is so important to, especially for young gay men to find. The anthology, you know, we all read to find escape. We all read to visit other worlds, visit other places. So having a collection of speculative fiction from a queer perspective is just like, it's transformative to say the least. And my favorite new book is Old School Indian by Aaron John Curtis. Aaron John Curtis happens to be a bookseller at Books and Books in Florida. So it was really, it's amazing for me as having been the only Native bookseller in my circle to be able to read another Native bookseller's novel. His novel is, again, without shame. He talks about polyamory. He talks about, you know, just being open sexually with his partners. And also he brings in traditions. He brings in healing. He brings in the magic of earth medicine. And phenomenal. Like, it is such a powerful book. And then I also want to talk about Just Now in Paperback. It was my favorite hardcover a couple of years ago. It's volume one, volume two of Mischief Eagle Testicle by Kent Monkman and Giselle Gordon. And beautifully illustrated. From what I understand, the art came first and the story came second. It is the most, and I do mean this, the most mind-blowing, mess with everything you think you know and everything you don't know you have as a bias until you discover that this book takes that bias apart. It is clever. It brings in the whole creation of the universe up into now, which, you know, is amazing in two volumes. The humor, the grace, and just the profoundness of being able to show the world being birthed into where we are now.
Okay.
Phenomenal.
What about old school Indian? That title is, I can't always think of myself as an old school Indian at this point in my life. How does that title correlate to the story?
So it could be that the main character is trying to hold on to the traditions, and he does return to the reservation after much time away from the reservation and living in Florida and stuff to heal. He has an illness. And for me, I think it's his uncle that is the old school Indian, because he is the healer and he really relies on the traditions, yet navigates it through a modern lens. There's other theories, but I do believe it is that the nod to holding on to the language, holding on to the magic, the mysticism, and to our ancestors, what our ancestors lived.
Mm-hmm. Cal, overall, what about the industry for LGBTQ books? Is it growing? Are you seeing increased demand? What does the future hold?
I am seeing more and more authors. And the nice thing is I'm seeing less and less marginalization. More importantly, I'm seeing more and more Indigenous authors. Canada has been way ahead on publishing Indigenous authors from the United States, but I dare say we're getting to the point where we're good competition in that contest. And more and more queer or somewhere in the queer alphabet authors are getting printed, are getting published, and these perspectives and joy, you know, more poetry. You know, I've been a big fan of Kim Shuck, the Cherokee poet, and now I'm a huge fan of Kinsale Drake. And the fact that we are having these beautiful Native voices beyond the legends that are being published and being shared is phenomenal.
Mm. How long has your bookshop been open now?
Since 1977, and I have been here for 4 years.
For 4 years. So you purchased it then from a previous owner?
Yes. I actually, this back to Edmund White. I discovered Edmund White as a teenager at the King's English Bookshop and fell in love with the space. Found so much joy in finding such a bold queer story in my, you know, 19-year-old hands, and it inspired a career that has now lasted about 31 years in bookselling. You know, I've lost track of how many books I put into other people's hands, and here we are, full circle. I've come home to lead the most colonial slave bookshop in America.
Well, Cal, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Really appreciate when you can spend time with us and share your experience and all of your expertise with our listeners. I know you've got other things going on today, so I want to be mindful of your time. But thanks again, Cal, for joining NAC today.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you all for listening.
You bet. Felix, I want to go back to you, bring you into the conversation, talk more about the exhibit, but also you've done work trying to better understand Two-Spirit culture in your community, diving into some of these themes that we heard Cal talk about, history and language. And what were some of the main takeaways about gender and sexuality in your community?
Yeah, so one of the things is that I realized that, you know, myself being trans, like I've always felt a, you know, an incongruence with the gender role that I was, you know, pressured to fulfill. I tried to be enough for it. And, you know, that was, you know, that's just a common feeling in my life. And I thought that I might be the only one that had that feeling. And so in doing historical research, as well as like just being vulnerable and open and talking with people in the community, I found that that feeling is everywhere, that not being enough. And it's not just those of us that are queer and trans. And, you know, looking into the history of it, I realized that assimilation affected all genders, not just, you know, queer genders, as we would, you know, describe them today. You know, when I, like with doing linguistic research, you realize that things rarely translate across languages one to one. And that there's always these more complex cultural concepts interacting. And so people, you know, were translating things with a lot of, you know, a lot of nuance and consideration, except for man and woman, which, you know, what I came to realize is like those concepts do not translate across cultures very well. So it's, assimilation didn't just hand, you know, didn't just like, you know, change all of these other aspects of culture or attempt to change it. It also changed the idea of what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman, and into a system that is, you know, constantly causing us to be measured up and perform these, you know, these different roles, and to police each other also is, you know, part of the encouragement of the system.
Thanks, Felix. We've got a caller on the line. This is Penny listening in Minnesota, tuning into the show online. Hi, Penny. You are on the air. What's your comment?
Hi, bonjour. Felix, I'm a big fan. I've been following you on Facebook. I've been following the both exhibitions for several years now. I had a comment and a question. One was, it was very encouraging to me that both you and Anthony Hudson present yourselves as not professional historians and not professional curators either. And that's, I think that's encouraging for people in community that feel like something should be done, that we don't have to wait for permission. We don't have to wait for an academic degree to go ahead and do some work that's important. So thank you very much for that. But I also had a question about when you were researching about Shumkum, your ancestor, what was, I thought it was very telling that, that you were looking for language that referred specifically to her as a trans person. And what did you find through that research? I think that's really important to bring forward.
Thanks, Penny. Felix, please respond.
Yeah. So I was very interested in finding a word, because I thought that maybe in finding a word, I'd find validation. I'd find that, you know, I'd find a lot of, well, especially a traditional or a searchable term for a traditional word, I'd find a lot of traditions. But I just find that indeed we do belong. And that was really what I was looking for. What I realized too is that the lack of a term doesn't necessarily mean the lack of acceptance or the lack of visibility. And, you know, coming back to that title, My Father's Father's Sister, like that is how people were referred to in our culture. And that was incredibly powerful. Like, we need terms today for advocacy, to organize ourselves, to do things like research. You know, there's so many things that that a term, you know, is incredibly important for. And our ancestors just didn't need a term the same way. So some of our languages might have had terms and some of our languages didn't. And at first, the lack of a term was discouraging, but then it changed. It turned into something more more empowering, because we're just members of our community. That's it. We're just part of things. And that was something that is really simple and yet like incredibly important.
Mm. Felix, tell us more about the Transgressors exhibit. Are there resources, more stuff available online? And for listeners who would like to learn more, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah. So Chichalu Tribal Museum at Grand Ronde, there's a website there, and that's where we started the exhibit Transgressors. That's where we had the exhibit My Father's Father's Sister. On there in archived exhibits, people can see information about both exhibits and see photos and see the virtual exhibit. So.
And what are some of your favorite pieces?
Oh, I always stumble at this question because, I like them all so much. I really do.
Well, just give a visual for because we're a radio show and we're talking about artwork. Just a little visual so our listeners can get some perspective.
Yeah. So Steph Littlebird's piece of, White Cindy, representing White Cindy, who is a Calamus, trans feminine ancestor, she's riding on this dark, stormy backdrop in this brilliant white dress with colorful ribbons streaming. And, that's an incredibly powerful image, and it kind of, sets off the exhibit, as White Cindy is riding off with the ribbons trailing behind her. And then in the exhibit throughout it, you see these ribbons as though White Cindy just rode through. And so the ribbons are, flapping in the turbulence, and in a way we're riding together through this, through the space.
That's the painting that's on the Facebook page. I'm looking at it now. Yeah. It's really, really, it just really stands out. Love the background and the colors, and awesome, awesome piece. Felix, we got about a minute before we have to take another break, but tell me a little bit more about the partnership you have with your co-curator, Anthony, and what you folks hope to continue to accomplish together.
Yeah, so we want to bring healing to our communities, not just, the minority group of us within the community, but the whole community. Things that have to do with us have to do with our communities because we're a part of them. And so really what we're hoping to do is reduce the stigma, reduce the shame that so many of us are carrying, especially around gender, and increase acceptance. Just also make it so that, so many people feel very alone in their struggles. We want to make it so that people don't feel alone.
All right. Felix Furby, one of two co-curators of the Transgressors exhibit at the Museum of Natural and Cultural History in Eugene, Oregon. Take a short break and we'll be right back.
Cliche. Guys, don't wait until you have symptoms. Regular checkups may catch health issues early, and conditions like diabetes, heart disease, liver disease, and prostate cancer are more treatable when caught early. Ask your Indian healthcare provider what healthcare checks are recommended for your age and lifestyle. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, ELAQUA.
This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. Through service with AmeriCorps Vista, you gain valuable professional experience and leadership skills while helping organizations in your community alleviate poverty. Find a service opportunity at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Support by the American Indian College Fund. The American Indian College Fund provides millions of dollars of scholarships to thousands of Native students every year. Tribal citizens of every age and experience are eligible. The deadline for applications is May 31st, and you can find everything you need to apply at collegefund.org. That's collegefund.org, or by phone at 800-766-FUND. Education is the answer.
Support by Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo Companies for shipments to rural Alaska for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com. Support for this program provided by ConocoPhillips Alaska,
operating in Alaska for more than 50 years and valuing the opportunity to partner with Alaska Native communities.
We're glad you're with us today on Native America Calling. We've been discussing Pride Month this hour. We also want to talk about a Native actor who just lost his life to an act of violence. Jonathan Joss was killed in an altercation with another person in his home state of Texas. Joss had a long-running role on the animated series King of the Hill as the voice of John Redcorn. He also had a recurring role in the series Parks and Recreation. Let's talk more now, and to do that, we have Vincent Schilling, who joins us from New York. He is the editor and founder of NativeViewpoint.com. He's also a certified Rotten Tomatoes critic. He is Akwesasne Mohawk. He's been on the show many times, and I welcome him back now. Vince, hello. Great to have you on the show again.
Hey, Sean. Thanks for having me, buddy. How you doing?
I'm doing okay, but this is a big loss here, brother. Jonathan Joss, he did a lot of projects, did a lot of work. Let's talk more about his career and just the special qualities that he brought to roles like the Magnificent Seven remake. He was in that 2010 version of True Grit. He was on television. Vince, geez, you know, how you feeling here?
Well, it's really... It's sad that we have to have something like this tragedy come up for us to talk about him. You know what I'm saying? It kind of pained me to look through his career, and he said something really gracious one time. He's like, well, you know, I really tried. I thought I was going to be a big shot in Hollywood, and I just didn't get all the roles that I wanted, you know, but I loved doing what I was doing, auditioning and things like that. And I'm just like, you know, sometimes it pains me to see that someone really struggles as much as he did in some ways. But, you know, I think though, it's just really about looking at someone as a person, someone who they are and what they try to do and try to accomplish in terms of the love they bring to the planet. You know what I'm saying? And I think that gets lost so many times and, you know, I'm glad you guys are taking this moment to celebrate him. I think it's very special.
Absolutely. Well, I think he's probably best known for his role as John Redcorn in King of the Hill. I remember the first time I saw Jonathan Joss in a film. It was Christmas in the Clouds. I don't know if you remember that when it's going back a few years, but he was fantastic in that. And but let's talk about John Redcorn and just what are your thoughts on that character in what Jonathan Joss brought to that role?
John Redcorn? It was funny, you know, and it was like, wait, what? Here we are watching this random show about, you know, guys just hanging out at the fence, drinking beers and doing that. And wait, there's a native in there. Wait, what is that? This is something that you're not accustomed to seeing, especially not when it first got started years back, you know, and it was thrilling, you know, because so many times it makes me think of the social media post I saw one time is like natives are all proud to see themselves on the side of a U-Haul, you know, because they had U-Haul had the native on it one time. And so we just like, anytime we see a native, we're like, hey, there's a native. But, you know, I'll tell you, as much as I love the fact he was played John Redcorn, my favorite of all of Jonathan Joss, what he did was just the incessant arrow thunking into Vincent D'Onofrio as the character Jack Horn in Magnificent Seven, just a and it just took him out, and it just D'Onofrio just died sitting there. I was like, that was just an epic scene to me. If anything, and then of course Martin Sensmeyer takes him out. But I was just like, that was his most epic scene. I think I just was like, wow, you know, that was cool because he was brutal in that movie. I thought he did excellent.
Well, let's hear some examples of Jonathan Joss's work, Vince. This is a short clip from his role as Chief Hotate on the comedy series Parks and Recreation. He had a recurring role as the leader of a local tribe and frequently satirized Native stereotypes. He's talking now with Amy Poehler's character, Leslie Knope.
We put up a memorial plaque and we have a Wangapoke exhibit in the history tent.
I completely understand you, but this is sacred burial ground, and I just hope that the souls of my ancestors don't don't put a curse on this festival. There are two things I know about white people. They love Matchbox 20, and they are terrified of curses.
Vince, what did you think of Chief Hotote?
I thought it was just great, and it just pains me to see why wasn't Hollywood more aware of things like this and using this type of funniness? You know, Native people are the original storytellers. Like, and I think Hollywood's starting to discover now, oh my gosh, you know what? Native people have a lot of good stories to tell. So I'm going to applaud the fact that they did give him that chance, they did give him that role, and he was able to bring such hilarity, because a lot of people that watch these really big shows, these really, you know, well-viewed shows that are very, very popular, they go, wait, Native people can be funny? And I think that's a true shocking thing, because what he did in many ways is undid that stereotype of us standing next to the fence post with our arms crossed and standing there the entire time during the entire movie. We're not that way. I've told so many people so many times as an arts and entertainment writer that Native people are hilarious. We have hilarious conversations. We laugh all night long if we hang out. And people are like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, and the thing is, we're talking right now about Jonathan Joss having died, and we're laughing about the joy he brought to the world, you know? So, and I really want to say thank you to you, Sean, for what you're doing and bringing his story to light here. You know, we're honoring him. It's an honor that he deserves.
Well, let's hear some more from Jonathan. He appeared on our show in 2016, and he told host Monica Brain about how he prepared for portraying unfavorable characters.
When you perform, it's not too far from who you are. And like I said, I usually play pretty dark characters, and it's easy for me to see that darkness. All I have to do is look in the history books or remember the stories and thinking of bodies being left to freeze. I think of dogs that are being told to attack people on their own land, trying to protect water, not just for their family, but for the world. So for me to do what I do is not that hard, because I'm aware of the tragedies. I'm aware of the stories. I'm aware of the strength that the Native people have. So it's not a far stretch for me to go into character, because I live life in character. I live my life as a strong Indian man, aware of the atrocities that have occurred to us, but with a willingness for things to change. And I think that's so important for any actor when they approach that role. There has to be that window of change there somewhere. Whether it happens or it doesn't happen, for an actor, he must accept the belief that his character can change. So that's how I approach the roles, with history, you know, in my back pocket, with the stories, you know, that my ancestors have told me. It's real easy being Indian. All you got to do is breathe.
In his previous interview on our show, Jonathan Joss also said he worked to provide depth to his John Redcorn character on the animated series King of the Hill.
Well, basically, you know, I wanted John Redcorn to stand for something more than just having an affair with this white lady. And we're talking to Fox, we came to an agreement and decided to do some really fun things with him and let him have an arc, even though it was a running laugh, you know, that he was having that affair. But the people at Fox really kind of understood, even though at first they were like, Jonathan, you do realize you're wanting to change a cartoon. Well, I said, well, that's true, but you have to understand that when it comes to Native roles on television, we don't have a lot. So we have to take advantage of those characters that we do have. And the cartoon at that time in my life was how I could have changed the world. And with the help of Fox and the wonderful writers and Greg Daniels, we turned him into a little more fun character. We got away from that relationship with Nancy. He started following his music career. He started following his own business career. He became a more filled out character, and he had that type of arc. Again, and not many shows allow a character to change for the better. And Fox allowed John Redcorn to do that. and what was left after the relationship, I think is a much better, full, fun, rounded character. And that was my contribution to get Jonathan, or get John Redcorn out of the window and onto a platform to where he could represent what he was in a little better way.
Interview with Jonathan Joss back in 2016 with Monica Brain. And Vince, I imagine you interviewed Jonathan Joss before. What do you remember about talking with him?
Just, you know, I just have to say, I am blown away by that interview. I'm blown away by what he just said. You know, that's incredible. And he is just an insightful, you know, it goes to show you that we, what we see, you know, it's not just a cartoon. I know that the people at Fox think it's just a cartoon, but you know what? It's not. It's the defining of who we are to people, because how much of Native culture is defined by cartoons? Look at Bugs Bunny, for God's sakes.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
And if you think
cartoons
about who
can
he is,
push narratives in a different way too, which is so exciting. The flexibility
that
they offer.
Oh my gosh, yes. And my thoughts are this, and this is especially considering he was shot and killed for who he was, you know, and I really thought about this long and hard. I put a lot of thought in over the past, you know, little while I wanted to say this, because I was worried at first. I was like, wow, how could he just be shot and killed? What a terrible way to go. Such as something to die in vain. But I really thought about it. I was like, you know what? He didn't die in vain. And it's really unselfish, because if you think about it, many people judge someone based upon their sexual orientation. And I've heard many people say things regarding same-sex relationships. I had a Google community years ago where people said things like, you know, H-E dot double hockey stick no, you know, to being same-sex relationship. And I don't think Joss's death was in vain. And if you think about it, when people judge, they not realize the depths of how much judgment can hurt us. But when Josh died, his husband was there with him. Can you imagine the depths of sadness that he felt and was affected by as he's dying? So if people think about their hatred or their judgment or this and that, this got real. This got real and deep. And I think people said, whoa, maybe I don't need to hate so much. Maybe I don't need to judge so much, because you know what? At the end of the day, there was two people who loved each other, and one of them watched the other one die. Come on, guys. Wake up. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why he died in this way. So maybe a lot of people, and hopefully in the Native community, will think, you know what? Maybe I don't need to judge. Maybe I need to realize that people can love each other, and it doesn't matter. You know, all people. You know, and not just Native people, but all people realize that, look, okay, neighbors were throwing insults back and forth and saying, you know, homophobic slurs, this, that, whatever. But look how it ended up. Is it worth it? My gosh, let's think about that. So I think the reason he went through all he went through was to make a statement. Wow, I am so blown away by what he said, Sean. Thank you so much to you and you guys for doing that research and pulling that out so I got to hear that. What a gift.
Holy yeah, God, you bet. Really you bet, me. Vince. You know, the producers put those clips together and they went through some of those old files and everything. So, yeah, just great work there on the studio end. And Jonathan Joss, he had that deadpan humor, that just, you know, the kind of that dry element of comedy. And he had some really great roles, but Vince, do you ever think of any other roles or types of roles that you'd have liked to have seen him play, just to kind of expand on his range?
You know, I would have loved to have seen him in like some kind of funny role alongside Gary Farmer in Reservation Dogs, you know.
Oh, yeah,
let him have the humor, because I know that dude's funny, you know. But you know what? It what happened is what happened. You know, and that's another thing, which is we got to watch out in life for the shoulda, coulda, wouldas, because they just cause nothing but pain. We got to really accept what happened and what we did and what we are experiencing, you know, because I think wow, I am so affected by what you guys did. I'm so affected by that show today, you know, and I just want to say thank you to Jonathan for everything he did. And, you know, and I'm going to go back and watch all those episodes of King of the Hill with that in mind. Because I didn't have that perspective. I didn't know he put that much homework into it. So I think people get to learn that too. So maybe we can go back and revisit some of the things he's done and go, wow, with a new, profound, open eye to what he did. And I really want to thank him for that. And I'm sure he can hear us now. And my heart goes out to Tristan and his family, because I can't imagine how people feel right now. But you know what? We got to bring love to this equation, folks. We got to bring love to this equation called life, because it's killing us if we don't. This judgment, and I don't mean just Native people. I mean everyone. This is really important. Well, I have to say again, I'm profoundly affected by what he said. Wow. Wow, Sean. And profound thanks to you guys. I really mean that. I'm really affected by today's show. Really, really intensely. My gosh, what a gift. What a gift.
Vince, I don't know what I can add. I mean, I just, you know, I've never heard you talk like this, this candidly. And frankly.
It just affected me. Wow. Yeah. This guy, one of our peeps was shot and killed in the name of what? Anger, this, you know, but at the same time, you know, we can laugh because Jonathan Joss was funny. And I'm excited now. I'm like, I'm jonesing to go watch some of those King of the Hill episodes now because he's funny.
All right, brother. It's always a pleasure when you're able to join the show. Really appreciate you spending time with you. Take care, okay, Vince?
All right, Sean. Good talking to you, buddy.
We're you 50, too,
brother.
All right. And big thanks to Vince Schilling and our other guests, Cal Crosby and Felix Ferbey. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up. But we'll be back Monday looking into the difficulty that comes when tribes are forced to relocate because of the increasing threats of climate change. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our producers are Sol Traverso and Andy Murphy. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Sho McPolin is the digital producer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief operations officer. The president and CEO of Quantic Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. Have a safe weekend. I'm Sean Spruce.
It is Kaya, Lesti, Yjiti, this case kill, Yjatani Loska, Nigas Tanega, Yjagolia, Akai, Yanatello, Ho, Tatalega, Alanusti, Tatnakase, Jatantoi, a hug, Uwela, a hug, Ala prostate, a daheski, Akai, Uniwata, a hidige, on a wadi, Jatata, Tianiaria, a Yelanudan, Dega, Unaxes, Tohi, Yiki, Nusta, Heha, he are getting us a Medicare, Alamedicate, Unadaska.
Global business executives, top government officials, diplomats, and indigenous leaders will attend Arctic Encounter 2025, North America's premier Arctic policy and business event. From July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska, this international summit convenes voices from across the Arctic and beyond to shape policy, investment, and innovation in the far north. Arctic Encounter is where global decisions meet northern realities. Early bird registration closes June 15th at arcticencounter.com, who supports this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. We'll be right back.
children's got swing. Maybe haven't got money, maybe haven't got shoes.